If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
Oh my God. Completely locked. Oh, I see.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
For Talk Radio News Service, I'm Jeff Holtzman. The IRS's targeting of conservative groups did not originate in Cincinnati, says the House Republican in charge of tax policy. Congressman Dave Camp told reporters today that he's still not sure where the targeting started. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor said the House will continue to look into the issue.
I think it is imperative for all of us here in Washington to work together to restore our trust in government.
The House Appropriations Committee has passed a $512 billion defense bill despite objections from Democrats who say the measure ignores spending caps set by sequestration. The bill is $28 billion over the cap set by the mandatory spending cuts. It includes $86 billion for the war in Afghanistan, which is $5 billion more than what the Pentagon requested. And FEMA is denying an appeal for funds to rebuild West Texas, where 15 people died and 150 buildings were destroyed by an explosion at a fertilizer plant back on April 17th. Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service, Washington.
Hi there. Something like the middle of June edition of Radio Free America. Duke Brooks is my name. This is ConservativeNationRadio.org. The number is 718-305-7176, and I will be completely honest with you. I am very excited about tonight's show. My guest, starting at around, about 40 minutes from now, is John Parshall, who is the author, along with his writing partner, Anthony Tully, of a tremendous book that is called Shattered Sword, The Untold Story of the Battle of Midway. Now, we're going to be talking about other things as well, you and I. However, the Battle of Midway, the 69th anniversary of it, was about a week ago. John was in Hawaii. He was on Oahu at Ford Island, giving the keynote speech for the commemoration of the battle. If you're not really into major battles in World War II, you might want to hang out because this one was extremely important. It was tremendously powerful. As far as I'm concerned, it had everything in it that that a battle really ought to have. First off, it was a dramatic American victory, and it was not the kind of victory that we would today describe as a victory. A victory today for our armed forces, unfortunately and sadly, is when we can say that the enemy's cultural sensitivities were not offended. And if the enemy did not have their feelings hurt, if they didn't get their hair mussed, and, you know, we didn't lose more than a few hundred guys, then we're calling that a victory. That's not a victory. That's not what a victory was in World War II. Someone came into the chat room and pointed out to me that it is the 71st anniversary of Midway. And, yeah, that's correct. It was the 69th anniversary of D-Day. Look, I can't add, okay? I mean, you remember the film Apollo 13 by Ron Howard? And there is Tom Hanks and Kevin Bacon the guy that played Hudson in Aliens. I'm not really sure. Anyway, they're in the spacecraft, and at one point, Kevin Bacon is asked, you know, how did you figure that we don't have the right reentry trajectory? And he looks at them and he says, I can add. And I always envied Kevin Bacon, you know, playing the astronaut in that film. He goes, I can't. And as far as subtraction, which is addition's tricky pal, forget about it. Anyway, I can repeat numbers. 718-305-7176 is the number here at Radio Free America. We're about 5 minutes after the hour. I guess the scandals in Washington, D.C. are just going to, you know, I just that they're just going to keep on coming, you know. And it seems there has been one every day for about the last 3 weeks. And I am wondering, you know, when the American people actually going to figure out that the Democrats are simply not fit to formulate and execute policy? Now, there are, you know, people often say to me, well, you know, the Democrats, the Republicans, they're all the same. That is not true. Unfortunately, when they get into the Congress, they all begin acting like congressmen, not like Republicans or Democrats. And I'm sure you remember, if you're old enough, that Wednesday morning in November of 1994, I will never forget waking up that morning, and this was before Fox News, so I had to watch CNN, darn it, and I remember some of those anchors like Patrick Emery and Susan Rook, and those people, Major Garrett, I think, was with them back then. And they had it was clear they were emotionally vested in the outcome of the previous day's nationwide midterm elections, because the Democrats had lost control for the first time in about 40 years of the House and the Senate, and the Republicans had gained control. And the CNN anchors and correspondents were beside themselves. They went out of their way to try to conceal it, but they were beside themselves. They just could not believe that this had happened. They were shocked. You may recall later on that day, Peter Jennings on ABC News, who was not even an American, God rest his soul, said that the voters had thrown a temper tantrum the previous day, Tuesday, Election Day of 1994. He just couldn't believe that anyone in the country would actually want Republicans to be in office and not to. He couldn't believe it. He was shocked, that the American people voted out the Democrats. One will also recall in 1991 or 92, the House Bank scandal. There was the Rosti, the Postman scandal. I mean, listen, these people are in there for themselves. They are not in there for you or me. They are in there for themselves. Now, look, I know a couple of U.S. congressmen personally. I know at least, I can say now I know two United States senators personally. They are perfectly nice people. There's no question about it. But let's start judging them by their actions instead of by what they say. Anyway, I am hoping that the American people this next November, November of 2014, are going to realize that the Democrats really don't want to do anything about stopping the IRS from preventing Tea Party groups from engaging in effective and level playing field fundraising against liberal groups, because that's what it was all about. You probably heard my friend Jeff Holtzman in Washington at the beginning of this netcast or podcast, however, I hope you're listening to it as a podcast. I hope you're listening to it live. I see a couple of folks lurking in the chat room. Thank you very much. Today, the Republican chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, Congressman Camp, said apparently, you know, they don't say things like this unless they can back it up, that there were orders from IRS HQ in Washington, D.C., that the IRS was to begin be on the lookout for conservative groups, for Tea Party groups, for groups that had the word patriot in their name, groups that had the word Constitution in their name, groups that had the phrase 9/12 in their name. Be on the lookout for them. Don't give them the same 501c3 or 501c4 status that was given to the Barack Hussein Obama Foundation in Boston, which was set up by the president's half-brother, this dude from Kenya that apparently has like a whole string of drunk driving arrests. He got his Obama Foundation 501c3 or C4 tax-exempt status in less than 30 days after applying for it. There are some Tea Party groups that formed in 2010-2011 that still have not gotten their tax-exempt status from the IRS. It's just unbelievable. Absolutely incredible. And there are Democrats out there that are saying, hey, this is okay. You know, we really don't have any problem with this. Good grief. Listen, we'll talk. But speaking of politics, as you're aware, I'm coming from Delaware. Delaware is a very small state, only three counties. Geographically, the second smallest state behind Rhode Island. In terms of population and the number of counties, it is smaller than Rhode Island. So geopolitically, we're the smallest state in the union. There's no place in this state that is more than about a one-hour drive from the state capital. I mean, it's small. Everybody knows everybody. And one of the people I know is this guy that lives up in the northern end of the state. His name is Christopher Manti. He is a Delaware political veteran. He knows what he's doing. And you want to listen up to his show right here on conservativenationradio.org. It's called The Christopher Manti Show. Now it's coming at you right here every Friday night at 5 p.m. Eastern, 4 Central. Christopher has a fresh take on conservative thought, our modern America, the threat of Sharia law, and the weird, wild, wacky, wonderful world of Washington, D.C., plus some heavy metal rock and roll thrown in for good measure, because Chris is somebody that is referred to as a headbanger. That's a phrase for people that love heavy metal. And that's his bumper music and breakbeat. He is a heavy metal guy. He is also a pretty profound Christian, a great conservative, and he's a particular friend of mine, and you will enjoy his show. It is the Christopher Manti Show, which we were thinking of naming simply Eponymous, which is a fancy word for named after itself. Comes to you Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern, 4 Central on conservativenationradio.org. Real conservatism for real conservatives. It is about 16 minutes after the hour. 718-305-7176 is the number here at Radio Free America. Duke Brooks is my name. As I mentioned, I've got a special guest tonight. His name is John Parshall. You will enjoy listening to John. If you are a fan of the History Channel, the Military Channel, the Military History Channel, or I guess somebody might even have a History of the Military Channel, who knows? If you see anything about the U.S. Navy in World War II, you will see John Parshall. John is an expert on the U.S. Navy in World War II. He's coming tonight from the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and we'll be hearing from him at about 20 minutes, 15 minutes before the next hour, so about half an hour from now. John's book, Shattered Sword, The Untold Story of the Battle of Midway, is killer. Came out several years ago, I think in 2005, we'll get that straight, but it's going to be an awful lot of fun, and I think that you will enjoy it. I hope that you stand by. If you've got any questions about the war in the Pacific and World War II, if I can't answer it, John can. So stand by. You're going to have a great time. I'm ready for your calls. We're going to take a quick break here. More political musings, I suppose, are coming up, so stay right where you are.
Aren't you glad the so-called fairness doctrine doesn't apply here?
Yep, that's the school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take your world for granted. Most days go by without a whole lot of surprises. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if everything familiar becomes anything but? Would you be prepared? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit. Make a plan. Be informed. Today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
A boy born in Joplin, Missouri was fascinated by anything with wheels and a motor. The odds of him going on to fascinate millions with his talent? 1 in 260,000. The odds of this born racer having 157 career top 10 finishes in NASCAR? 1 in 125 billion. But every driver seeks the pinnacle of their achievements. The odds of him winning both the Daytona 500 and the Brickyard 400 in the same year? 1 in 195 million. The odds of a child being diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm NASCAR driver Jamie McMurray, and my niece has autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Hey, liberals, why don't you try rooting for your own damn country for a change? You're listening to Duke Brooks on ConservativeNationRadio.org.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back. 18 minutes after the hour, Radio Free America on ConservativeNationRadio.org. Duke Brooks is my name. 718-305-7176 is my number. We've been talking a little bit about the scandal du jour out of Washington, D.C. I was just reminded that today is the 26th anniversary of Ronald Reagan's famous Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall speech in Berlin. And that was one of those moments that I think defined a generation. I remember when the Berlin Wall was built. I wasn't there. I was about 5 or 6, but it was on television. And, it was very, very troubling. Very troubling. I mean, I realized something was up at that age. And I realized that the communist Soviets were the bad guys at that age. My parents certainly did. I think anti-communism is in my DNA, pretty much. But in any event, Ronald Reagan made that speech. It was one of those moments that kind of defines a generation. It was very much, to me, as memorable, at least as memorable as John F. Kennedy's, I think the most memorable thing that he said in his entire presidency of little less than 3 years was, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. That was a perfect way to describe what the American people's relationship with their government should be. And now, unfortunately, it is, don't ask what you can do for your country, ask what your country owes you. And there are people out there, and we call them statists, and I got to be honest with you, there are some Republicans that think this way as well. I can think of a few off the top of my head. I don't want to name any names, but the initials are John Boehner, who seems absolutely determined not to let government shrink at all. He's a Republican. He speaks like a conservative. John McCain would be another one like that, no question about it. Probably Orrin Hatch would be in that same. I mean, there are quite a few Republicans who really don't want to see government shrink. The problem back in 1994 on that Wednesday morning when I was shocked and stunned to realize that the Republicans had taken over, one of the first people that they interviewed on TV that morning was former Senator Bob Dole. Bob Dole is a Republican. He was a Republican. He was the Senate Minority Leader, and the next day he became the Senate Majority Leader. And Senator Dole he was a good guy, but he was kind of a big government Republican. He, you know, I suppose one might say that one of the differences between the when they actually get into Washington, when they actually get into the Congress, into the House or into the Senate, regardless of what they do when they campaign, it seems pretty clear that Republicans and Democrats alike, once they get there, they want to see government grow and they want to see government get big. What that big government is used for is a very different kettle of fish between the Republicans and the Democrats. Both parties have misused government in the past, but they do it for different reasons. Republicans want to grow government, generally speaking, to deal with international problems and for the purposes of defense. I'm pretty much down for that. I'm pretty much okay with that. The Democrats will use big government to bludgeon their domestic political opponents. That's the difference. We see it now. There's any question about it. Why did the IRS do what it did? Well, we found out early on, about 3 weeks ago, two or three weeks ago, that Shulman, who was the acting commissioner of the IRS at the time all this was happening, at first they thought he had made 118 visits to the White House. Now, as of last week, it was revealed he made 157 visits to the White House. And at some point in 2010, he made his first visit to the White House. Apparently, the next day, instructions came from IRS HQ in Washington to their various tax-exempt offices around the country, including Cincinnati, I'm presuming including Rochester, New York, that they were to be on the lookout for groups, Tea Party, Conservative, Constitution. Oh, my. Can you imagine? Who do these American people think they are? Reading the Constitution? You're not supposed to do that. Only lawyers and federal judges should know what the Constitution says. How dare you? How dare you? I mean, seriously, is that not what they're coming from? Is that not their attitude? I mean, I can't be the only one that thinks this. 718-305-7176 is the number here at Radio Free America. All right, you chat room lurkers, there's quite a few of you there. Thank you very much. Glad to see you. May have another one soon. Well, we'll see. But in any event, that's basically what we are getting from this big government. And as if using the IRS to hamper the fundraising abilities of their political opponents is not enough of an affront to the American people, if it is not enough of an insult to the American people, if it isn't enough of a sort of condescending castigation and chiding of the American people. How dare you? There was a group that was a pro-Israel group. The pro-Israel group was denied their 501c3 and C4 status, and they were told by the IRS that we think you may be aiding and abetting terrorism in Israel, and you seem to be in favor of policies that the Obama administration opposes. So we're not going to let you do any fundraising tax-free. Now, to be fair, at least to be honest or open or something, in the interest of full disclosure, yes, they could still do all the fundraising they wanted. It just wouldn't be a tax-exempt donation to them, and the people making the donation would not be able to deduct it from their gross income. Those are the two key factors. If you have to pay taxes on your donations, then you are going to be, by definition, hampered. You're going to have fewer dollars with which you can work. If you're not allowed to deduct it from your income tax, margin, if you're not allowed to deduct it from your gross income, which gives you a lower marginal rate, then you're going to be less inclined to give money to a group, a donation to whom you cannot deduct it yourself. And that is kind of the 1-2 punch against fundraising. That's what the Obama administration did. About a week and a half ago, I thought, I got to be honest with you, I can't imagine the president himself sitting in the White House and calling in Shulman from the IRS and saying, "You're that new commissioner that we got hooked up into the job, right?" Yes, sir, Mr. President. "I'll tell you what, here's what I want you to do. I want you to tell the IRS that these Tea Parties are a problem. They are bothersome. And I want you to shut them down. Don't let them get tax-exempt status. And anybody that gives money to them, go ahead and single them out, audit them too. I don't care what the law says. I want them stopped." I've got to be honest. A week and a half ago, I just thought, no, there's no way. There is no way that he would do anything like that. I've changed my mind. I believe that that is exactly what he told the IRS commissioner to do, and I believe the next day that is exactly what the IRS commissioner did. There isn't any question in my mind. I mean, the dots are there. They're going to be connected. It's only a matter of time. The media can avoid it all they want. Do you know Congressman Elijah Cummings from Baltimore, Maryland? I first moved to Baltimore and started living there full time in 1987. Pretty sure he was the congressman then. I think he was the congressman there maybe as far back as the Battle of Fort McHenry during the War of 18. I mean, he's been one of these guys. He's a minority congressman. He has what is known as a safe congressional district. In other words, through gerrymandering, it was carved out so way more than half of his constituents are also persons of color, and the presumption is that a black voter will vote for a black candidate just because of the race of the voter and the candidate. one might observe that if white people did that, they would be called racists, bigots, prejudicial, xenophobic, homophobic, misogynistic, fascist, all that kind of stuff. But if a black person votes for a black candidate just because they're black, that's okay. That's all right. But I digress. The other day, Congressman Cummings, I think I met him once a long time ago, a nice enough guy, but just a ridiculous left-wing liberal, almost as bad as that Maxine Waters in California. But Congressman Cummings on Candy Crowley on CNN the other day was saying, look, the IRS problem has been solved. They found out what the problem was. Now the inspector general is going to make a recommendation that'll fix it. Let us move away from this. It's over. It's done with. Why are they still on it? And Candy Crowley was sitting there. It was a split screen. And Candy Crowley, who by all accounts is actually a decent journalist, but she is biased. She's prejudiced. There's no question. Candy Crowley was sitting there nodding her head in what could only be interpreted as an enthusiastic agreement with the congressman's assessment of things. Journalists are supposed to adhere to certain ethical standards, and they are supposed to be objective. Maybe it won't get dark tonight. Who knows? It is really, you know, good grief. In any event, it is about 29 minutes now before the hour. ConservativeNationRadio.org, that would be us. We're proud to be associated with the best and most effective identity security and credit monitoring service that there is, and that, as you certainly know by now, is none other than LifeLock. LifeLock is an awful lot more than just a typical standard credit monitoring service. Oh, no. LifeLock helps to protect your personal information using a combination of data surveillance techniques and outstanding member service 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. There is really nothing that comes close to LifeLock. So to protect your identity with LifeLock, go to conservativenationradio.org and click on the LifeLock banner. Network may not cover all transactions and the scope may vary. That's conservativenationradio.org and click on the LifeLock banner. More of Radio Free America is coming up, so your calls don't go away.
This is Annie Lennox of Eurythmics, or RAD. Please don't drink and drive, and don't drive if someone else has been drinking. Thank you.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Happy anniversary, honey.
Oh, you shouldn't have. Wait, is that a goat?
Goats are a great gift, but maybe not for her. Go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com to give a goat and end hunger in South Sudan. So, do you like it? Goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
You're listening to Duke Brooks on ConservativeNationRadio.org.
Radio Free America at conservativenationradio.org. Duke Brooks here. Howdy to you. I was about to say good evening, but if you're listening on a podcast, it might be at 20 minutes after 3 in the morning or something. That's one of the beauties of being able to do this kind of program on the internet. 718-305-7176 is the number. About 10 minutes from now, I expect to be hearing from John Parshall. We're going to be discussing not only the Battle of Midway, but his excellent book, which he co-wrote with Tony Tully, that is called Shattered Sword, The Untold Story of the Battle of Midway. I am just, I'm all over the Battle of Midway, man. You know, I mean, I've been reading about it since I'm 12 years old, as they say. We have been talking tonight, or this time, rather, you and I, about the IRS scandal, the way the Democrats are kind of trying to downplay it. There are some people in the media that are trying to downplay it, too. It did not, you know, at first, they were, the media, the leftist media, were going out of their way to try to pretend that it didn't exist, give it the back of the hand, poo-poo it, tamp it down. Then some of them began to realize, wait a minute, if a liberal president can use the IRS to hamper the formation and effectiveness of conservative groups, couldn't a conservative president use the IRS to do the same thing to liberal groups? Well, we can't have that, can we? So that was basically what happened. And they began giving it some coverage, and it actually got some airtime on CBS, NBC, CNN, ABC, etc. Fox, of course, was leading the way. It's not that Fox has a serious right-wing bent to what they do, but the normal left-wing bias that we expect from the media is absent at Fox. That is what is really going on there. Their actual news coverage is fairly objective. I mean, it's about as objective as almost anything that I can remember ever seeing on broadcast news or cable news. They're nowhere nearly as far to the right as NBC is to the left. There is absolutely no question about that. And Fox separates their editorial and opinion programming from their news coverage. With the networks and the New York Times and the Washington Post, they bleed over onto each other. There is no line between them. In fact, the line has become so blurry that it is not a line anymore. It's indistinct. That's the way it is right now. However, last week, the New York Times, based on the next two latest scandal that has broken from the Obama administration, the New York Times put on their website, over the signature of the editorial board of the New York Times, that is the central core, the central philosophical core of the New York Times is their editorial board. There's no question about that. And they put out that the Obama administration has lost all credibility, period. They were talking about the National Security Agency bugging scandal. Then later in that same day, they softened it and they said the Obama administration has lost all credibility on this issue. Those are different things, clearly, but it's obvious that somebody at the New York Times has come to the conclusion that the Obama administration has some very, very serious problems, and they certainly do. So after the IRS, the next thing that happened, and this is what really turned the media for once to give that kind of hapless chump, Jay Carney, some actual guff and some actual static when he was addressing the gaggle in the White House press briefing room, which I believe is called the Brady press briefing room, named after James Brady. But in any event, they were giving the guy a real tough time after it was revealed that the Department of Justice had subpoenaed the phone records of Associated Press reporters. Then they realized, hey, wait a minute, that's a line you're not allowed to cross. We weren't all that concerned with what you guys were doing to Republicans and Tea Partiers, but if you're doing any, you're looking at our phone records, now we're mad. Now we're no longer on your side. Now you cannot count on us anymore. So that is basically it. That's when the tide sort of turned, kind of a sea change. The next thing that came out was that the National Security Agency was collecting phone usage for about 113 million Americans over a 2 or 3 month period this spring. Now, the guy, I think his name is Woodson, the guy that made that revelation, then he hightailed it to Hong Kong. He has left Hong Kong. He hightailed it to, I think his next port of call might be Russia. I heard earlier today that the Russians had come out and said, we'll give you asylum. Yeah, right. You know, like, what does he want to know? What do the Russians want to know from him? We'll give you asylum as long as you tell us everything you know about the American intelligence and signals intelligence apparatus. You know, some people say the guy is a traitor. Some say he is a hero. I know a guy that spent his career in the CIA, very conservative guy, with a serious libertarian streak. And the guy earlier today said to me, I think he's a hero. I wasn't really expecting that remark from my friend. I'm glad. Well, I've got to be honest with you. I'm really not sure where I fall on this thing. I guess I'm glad that it was revealed that this is what the NSA is doing, so the American people can see what those ludicrous thugs from Chicago, Obama and his friends, Valerie Jarrett, et cetera, are actually all about, what they, you know, what they really plan. But I think that the guy that made the revelation should be in very serious trouble. I mean, you know, the guy definitely broke the law by making that disclosure. Now, here's basically what it comes down to. There is the Bill of Rights. There is a Fourth Amendment to the Bill of Rights, which says, and I'm going to kind of paraphrase this, that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, in their property, in their papers, cannot be violated without a warrant. Actually, why don't I go ahead and read it? I found my pocket copy of the Constitution. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. In other words, at the end of the day, you can't just say, look, we're the government, we want your phone records. You can't do that. It is now about 17 minutes before the hour. I mentioned the leftist media a short while ago. The leftist media would really like it if conservatives like us were led to believe that we're just a couple of, you know, a minority of people, lonely voices out there in the wilderness. That's not the case. Americans that identify themselves as conservatives outnumber liberals by 2-1, and that comes from a whole lot of polls, even by the ones done by liberals. Now, if you, like me, respect traditional American values, there is a place for you to call home on the Internet. It's traditionalamericanmovement.com, or TRADAM, as we call it here at the massive CNR.org skyscraper building. TraditionalAmericanMovement.com is the place where real conservatives can meet up, minus the turf wars, and find out what's new in the conservative community. So join up, find out what's happening, and be a part of the conservative revolution, all on TraditionalAmericanMovement.com. That's www.TraditionalAmericanMovement.com. I do hope to see you there soon. Have no fear, it is a liberal-free website. About 16 minutes now before the top of the hour, as I mentioned, I will be having John Parshall, expert on the Battle of Midway, join me in a couple of minutes here. Just so that you understand, I want to just give you a real quick, basically set the scene for the Battle of Midway. It was early June in 1942, and at that time, the United States was losing World War II. We were losing World War II. In early May, we had only two aircraft carriers in the Pacific. I think we had one or two in the Atlantic. They brought one of them from the Atlantic, which is the USS Hornet. And that, in early June, the Battle of Midway began. And Jonathan Parshall and I are going to tell you all about it this evening. John, welcome aboard.
Well, hello.
How are you doing tonight, my friend?
I am delightful. Very happy to be here.
All right. Now, I am going to take a break, and I'm going to ask you to hang on.
Okay.
When we come back, we will be talking about the Battle of Midway, so please stay right where you are, okay?
You got it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It is just about 14 minutes now before the hour. Going to take a break, coming back with John Parshall, the writer of Shattered Sword, The Untold Story of the Battle of Midway, the best book about the most important and decisive naval battle in modern history, coming up after this, so don't go away.
The Internet's official rhino hunting safari.
Nurse, I need you to apply pressure to the head wound until I can get to it. I'm concerned she's lost too much blood.
Oh, no.
You in the corner, who are you? You're not supposed to be here.
She's my girlfriend, Doctor.
You need to wait out in the waiting room.
Please, Doctor, I want to stay with her.
Look, she's been badly injured. So if you want to do what's best for her, you need to let us do our work.
Please, Doctor, she has to be okay. I didn't mean to do this. I love her.
Wait a second. You were the driver?
Yes, but I didn't mean to. I swear, we went to dinner. I was just buzzed. I only had a few drinks.
Just buzzed? Why didn't you tell us that? In that case, your girlfriend is fine.
Hey, sweetie. I feel great. You want to get out of here?
I can't believe this. Really, Doctor? She's really okay?
What, are you kidding? No, not really. Nurse, get me a suture kit. Stat.
Buzzed driving. Maybe we should stop acting like it's no big deal. Buzzed driving is drunk driving. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, the Ad Council, and this station.
Whether you're on active duty, a veteran, or just admire American Armed Forces, there's no better place to get the widest variety of militaria than at Highlands Militaria. Highlands Militaria is one of America's premier distributors of Fox tactical gear and outdoor products. Veteran-owned and operated, Highlands Militaria offers new and used uniforms and insignia from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and today. With an emphasis on airborne and special operations insignia, gear, collectibles, and uniforms. If you need to replace a cherished badge or unit patch, or just want to gear up for your next outdoor adventure, go to Highlands Militaria at stores.ebay.com/Highlands-Militaria, where you'll find the best supply of the military gear you need. Shipping is always free with one-day handling time, and your satisfaction is guaranteed. Highlands Militaria at stores.ebay.com/Highlands-Militaria. And thank you for your service.
The Internet's official rhino hunting safari. You're listening to Duke Brooks on conservativenationradio.org.
This is Radio Free America on conservativenationradio.org. Duke Brooks here. Thanks very much for being along. The number is 718-305-7176. On the air with me now, let me welcome again John Parshall, the author of Shattered Sword, The Untold Story of the Battle of Midway. John, I'm very, very honored to have you with me tonight.
I'm delighted to be here, Duke.
Before we begin, real quick question. Who is the bassist for the Moody Blues?
Oh, sorry, man. Out of my era.
I'm more of an alt rock kind of guy.
That's a terrible answer, isn't it?
That's the trouble with you kids today. You know, I saw on one of your Facebook photos that you can't call yourself a fan of a band unless you know the name of the bassist.
Yeah, That kind of labels me there, doesn't it? I'm more of a Chris Squire, Geddy Lee kind of guy, I guess I'd have to say. And, of course, John
Chris
Paul
Squire.
Jones. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm a prog rock guy. That's how I was weaned, you know, back
okay.
in the day.
Hey,
so,
I don't think Emerson Palmer had a bass player, did they?
one would hope they did, but yeah. Yeah, that's Greg Lake, isn't it? Again.
Greg was, well, he was the guitarist. No, I'm sorry, he was the singer.
I'm a loser.
Well, I don't know. You know,
let's talk about aircraft carriers, man.
Yeah, it's been a long time ago. Now, here's, you know, I'm as I said, I'm very, very honored to have you on the air. I talk about American history quite a bit. I've been reading about the Battle of Midway since I'm 12 years old, as they say. And my first exposure to it was Walter Lord's book, Incredible Victory. And since then, I've read at least six or eight other books. But the best one, without any question, is yours and your book, Shattered Sword, The Untold Story of the Battle of Midway, which you published in 2005, correct?
That is right. And I'll just state for the record that I would have to say that Lord remains one of my favorite books, too. I mean, that's pretty tall praise to stack me up against him. His narrative style is just absolutely wonderful. And I'll say, too, that he was also incredibly kind to me and Tony as we were writing our book and helped us out enormously with sets of interview notes and so forth. What Lord didn't have that we did have was access to some of the Japanese source material, some of which had finally made it into English in the intervening years. Otherwise, I'm quite sure that Walter would have written some of the things that we wrote about. So, anyway.
I guess I knew at one point when I read your book that you had spoken with Walter Lord, and for those who may not be aware, he wrote his first book was called A Night to Remember, which was about the sinking of the Titanic. Later,
right.
He went on to write Day of Infamy, which is the best. I say to people, if you want to have a front row seat to the Battle of Midway and kind of almost actually be there, read Walter Lord. If you want to know what really was going on, what really happened, read John Parshall, because you have dissected certain things about the battle, and you have kind of moved aside certain legendary aspects of it that a lot of people like me took for granted. But
right.
Let's set the stage for people. It is early June in 1942, and here comes four Japanese aircraft carriers.
Yep.
Comprising the striking force, and all four of them had attacked Pearl Harbor. The
That's
Akagi,
right.
the Kaga, the Hiryu, the Soryu. And they wanted to take Midway, which is two very small islands surrounded by a coral reef that's about 1,300 miles west-northwest of Oahu.
That's right.
And if they had been able to take Midway, they could have set up a patrol plane range, which would have made it impossible for the U.S. to ever resupply Australia, which meant that they would have been able to take... Oh, you don't think so?
I'd quibble on that. Really?
Okay, all right.
The ostensible downside to losing Midway is that it puts Oahu within, as you say, air range of Midway and potentially sets up an invasion of the Hawaiian Islands by the Japanese. I personally don't think that was ever conceivable. First of all, I don't think that even if we had lost the carrier battle off of Midway, I don't think that the Japanese had the ability to take the islands away from us. Even if you posit that there would have been an amphibious landing against those islands after a loss by the Americans, the defenders outnumbered the attackers. The defenders were very well dug in. The Japanese didn't have much in the way of a gunfire support doctrine. I think it's just a slaughter at the water's edge, and that a lot of those Japanese troops probably wouldn't have even made it off the reef. Even if you then say, well, okay, let's say the Japanese take Midway, you've secured yourself this sort of postage size postage stamp-sized island out in the middle of nowhere. It's hideously exposed to air attack from Oahu, which is a much bigger place and has many more airfields and has hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of aircraft on it by, you know, the middle of 1942. So I don't see any way that the Japanese come away with a successful invasion of Oahu. And if you don't do that, well, then you're not going to be able to cut off the supply lines to Australia either. And the importance of Australia, just, you know, for our listeners is, you know, by the middle of 1942, the Japanese have carved out this enormous empire for themselves. And the economic reasons that they went to war to get the oil, the rubber, the tin, you know, all of the strategic materials that they needed, all of those were located in places like Java and Borneo and, you know, the what they called the southern resource area that's down in Indonesia. Well, if you're going to recapture those areas, Australia is a logical place to use as a base for that. The Japanese were very aware of that, and they were looking to put Australia out of business as well. But really, the main order of business, as far as the Japanese were concerned, was luring the American carriers out of Pearl Harbor, bringing them to battle someplace that was far enough away from Oahu's air power that they couldn't intervene, and yet close enough that the Americans would feel compelled to fight, and that's why they selected the island of Midway.
And if our code breakers, led famously by a guy named Joe Rochefort, at what was known as the Hypo Station at Pearl Harbor, if we had not broken, well, we didn't really break, but he was an obsessive cryptanalyst, and he could speak Japanese and read and write it absolutely fluently.
Yep.
If he had not been there and had not been able to infer that the Japanese were coming, and there, of course, you relate the two really famous events that confirmed this. One, that they knew the Japanese called Midway AF. And, you know, when I saw that, I thought, like, oh, gee whiz, you know, A as a, I mean, come on, man.
Yeah.
But beyond that, there had been a Japanese airplane that had come out to reconnoiter Pearl Harbor at some point. They
right.
intercepted his message. He mentioned he was passing near AF. They went over they triangulated every possible place that it could have been. They thought it was Midway. They were pretty sure it was Midway, but to confirm it, they used the Trans-Pacific cable, which could not be intercepted or tapped, to send a message to Midway.
To send that a message in clear. Yep, that their water filtration was
exactly.
done.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now,
and really what's going on there is you've got a bureaucratic battle going on, because what was happening in Pearl Harbor at the time was that the Pearl Harbor codebreakers were pretty convinced that it was Midway that was the objective, but they were...
But not Admiral King.
That's right.
Not Admiral
or
King.
Admiral King's, you know, cryptanalyst in Washington. So they were trying to
right.
demonstrate to Washington that, hey, we know what we're talking about, and this is where the battle is going to be. So, yeah, obviously, you know, the intelligence breakthrough on our end was enormous, and people have this sort of mental image of, oh, well, we broke the codes. That means that we're reading everything that the Japanese were sending out. And that's not true at all.
Not at all.
On a good day, we were reading, you know, maybe 4, 5, 6% of the message traffic. But when you combine that with other techniques, you know, we were able to get an insight as to pretty close to when, you know, this event was going to go down and then confirm that it was indeed against the island of Midway. And that gives then Admiral Nimitz in Pearl Harbor scant time to, you know, put together his assets and get them up to that neighborhood, which is our three carriers, the Yorktown, the Enterprise, and the Hornet.
And the Yorktown had just come back from getting really beaten up
yep.
at the Battle of the Coral Sea
yep.
in early May.
Yep.
And, you know, you detail, and Gordon Prang, in his book, Miracle of Midway, actually apparently got hold of some documents from Pearl and the U.S. Navy Bureau of Ships about, you know, which repairs they made to the Yorktown. From what I have heard or at least read, they wanted the Yorktown to have a six-month overhaul at that point.
Yep.
And they said, no, you've got about 2.5 days
yep.
to do whatever it is. There were still some civilian dock workers on board the Yorktown when it left Pearl Harbor with the band on the deck playing California, Here I Come. They weren't going anywhere near California.
Yeah. Well, and there's an interesting juxtaposition there, too, because, of course, on the other side of the pond, you know, the two main participants for the Japanese at the Battle of Coral Sea were the carriers Shokaku and Zuikaku, which arrived uh-huh. home at about the same time that Yorktown made it back to Pearl Harbor. Shokaku had been very badly damaged by bombs on her flight deck, and she was not going to be able to participate in the battle. But one of the things that we demonstrated in our book is that Zuikaku had not been physically damaged, but her air group had been savaged.
Mauled.
Yeah, just mauled. But, you know, between Zuikaku's own aircraft and those of Shokaku, they probably could have cobbled together some sort of a composite air group. We figured, you know, around 59 aircraft, which is a credibly sized air group. If they had wanted to, they could have gotten Zuikaku back into the mix in time to sortie for the Midway operation. But there was a sense of complacency amongst the Japanese that, well, you know, we've got our four oldest and bestest carriers. You know, we really don't need the juniors in the form of Zuikaku tagging along. So they left her at home. And, you know, when you sort of contrast that with, you know, the Americans are moving heaven and earth to get the Yorktown back into shape where she can actually do battle. I mean, to use a sports analogy here, you have to say that one side wanted the victory a whole lot more than the other, and that was the Americans.
John, I've got to take a break. Can you bear with me for about 2 minutes while we do our top of the hour break here? And I very much thank you for being with us. We'll be back to you in just about 2 minutes. This is Radio Free America on conservativenationradio.org. I'm Duke Brooks, and I'm speaking with John Parshall, who is the foremost expert on the Battle of Midway in June of 1942 extant. More with John coming up after this. Don't go away.
If you love America, you're among friends here. conservativenationradio.org.
It feels like you're frozen, petrified. You're struggling with your mortgage payments. The bills begin to pile up. Not knowing what to do, you do nothing at all. And that's the worst thing you can do. Because if you take action, if you do something about your mortgage problems, you're far more likely to get the most positive outcome. Making Home Affordable is a free government program. Call 888-995-HOPE to talk one-on-one with a housing expert about the options that are right for you. Real help, real answers, right now. Call 888-995-HOPE or visit makinghomeaffordable.gov and do something about your mortgage problems. Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Sure. Humans can be a little weird at times, but take it from me, I'm a dog. And a person is about the best thing that can happen to a shelter pet. So if you want to learn how you can be that person, get down to your local pet shelter or visit theshelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Radio Free America on conservativenationradio.org. My guest is John Parshall, who is the foremost expert on the Battle of Midway. John, we have a situation where Admiral Chester Nimitz is sending every single thing he can possibly get his hands on out to Midway, which comprises two small islands, Sand Island and Eastern Island. The airport was on Eastern Island, and it was ringed by coral, but we were under the gun, and we simply could not afford to lose that battle.
Yeah, no, I think that's a – well, Yes and no. There's no question, if you look at Nimitz's take on things, that losing the island was less important than potentially losing the carriers. And you need to understand, of course, that when he sent his two admirals, Fletcher and Spruance, out to do battle, he gave them very careful instructions about how they were to fight that battle, and famously instructs them that they are to be guided by
the principle of calculated risk.
Calculated risk, exactly. That you are not to expose your carriers unless you feel that they can do disproportionate damage to the enemy. And the implicit message there is that if you're in a bad situation, gentlemen, get your ships out of there. Because, again, Nimitz knew that if worse came to worse and Midway fell, that the Japanese have now just acquired for themselves this incredibly isolated, remote outpost that they're going to have a terrible time keeping in supply, that's much closer to our naval bases than it is to theirs. So really, you know, we could take back Midway, I don't want to say at will, but it would be relatively easy for us to do so. And therefore, you know, if push comes to shove, you're to leave the Marines there to defend that island without the benefit of the carriers. This is not the sort of fight that is worth taking down to the last bloody rowboat, if you will. We're here to sink Japanese carriers if we can. If we can't, then get the heck out of there is kind of what it comes down to.
Well,
now, but I'll grant you, and I'm returning to your earlier point, certainly from a morale standpoint, it's important that we start winning. You know, the first 6 months of this war have just been a train wreck for us, and really for the Allies in general. I mean, the Japanese have destroyed the Allied strategic position throughout the Pacific. And so, yes, it's vitally important that we demonstrate that we have a certain level of martial capability, if you will, that we are able to go toe-to-toe with the Japanese. We would very much like to take a win out of this thing, if at all possible.
This was the second battle in naval history in which the two surface fleets opposing each other never had actual sight of each other.
That's right.
Obviously, Coral Sea was the first one. So it was a question of launching airplanes and then recovering them on the carriers, finding the enemy. The Japanese made what they thought at the time were some good decisions, but they realized, I would say by about 7 or 8 minutes after 10 local time on the morning of June 4th, that they had really screwed the pooch.
Yeah.
And I suppose the one thing that, the one message that Admiral Nagumo, who was the on-scene commander, Chuichi Nagumo, although I guess the Japanese would refer to him as Nagumo Chuichi or
right.
Yamamoto Isoroku
right.
For his boss. He sent out his airplanes under the command of Mitsuo Fuchida, who had led the attack on Pearl Harbor 6 months earlier, to bomb Midway. That's the first thing that you're going to do.
Actually, they were under command of another guy named Tomonaga. Fuchida had an appendicitis on the carrier. And
that's right, right.
Yeah.
There are so
anyway.
Many details, and you've got them. And, you know, I think I kind of understand the broad strokes. But right about this time, it gets very, very confusing for me.
Yep.
And I say that for this reason. The Japanese attack force, on the way back from Midway, sent a message to their carriers that famously said there is need for a second attack.
Yep.
And at that moment, the Japanese decided to strike their airplanes that were loaded with armor-piercing bombs, anti-ship bombs, and torpedoes, and get them loaded up with iron bombs to use against land targets.
That's
and
right.
Apparently, right at that moment, there was a message from the infamous pilot of the number 4 scout plane from the cruiser Tone that there are American carriers east of us, northeast of Midway. Now, I had always read that the American carriers happen to be in the sector that was assigned to that particular Japanese scout airplane, and that that airplane was half an hour late getting off its catapult on that cruiser, and
right.
that is the reason the Japanese didn't know that we were there lurking with our three carriers, two task forces, a point luck, and that. But in your book, you go over in quite a bit of detail about the fact that this is simply not the case.
Yeah. Yeah, Tone number 4's scout plane gets to be the scapegoat for the problems of the Japanese recon plan, which, you know, had a lot of problems with it. I mean, in a nutshell, the Japanese were trying to search a surface of ocean about the size of Sweden with 7 airplanes, and, you know, guess what? You can't do that in the time allotted. But, yeah,
Tone
number 4 goes off the catapult a half an hour late. We still don't know why. You know, there may have been a misfire.
Yeah.
There may have been an engine failure. We don't know what happened, and we never will know because none of the guys on that plane ended up living through the war. But, yeah, he goes off a half an hour late, and he goes and does his thing. It turns out that if you actually run his search route where he should have gone, had he launched on time, flown out his 250 miles, done his little dog leg to the north, and then started flying back, he actually would not have found the Japanese or the American carriers for probably a half an hour to 40 minutes more than he did. And so, ironically, the fact that he left the catapult late and then apparently, you know, hot-dogged his route or flew up the middle of his search wedge or did something goofy, we don't know, ended up putting information in Nagumo's hands half an hour to 40 minutes earlier than Nagumo would have had it otherwise. The problem for Nagumo at that point, though, is that the carriers that are, you know, that are going to destroy him have already launched their aircraft. There's no way to preempt the Americans at this point from doing their thing. And what that sort of illustrates is we have this vision of aircraft carriers as this weapon system that can launch aircraft on a moment's notice, and, you know, you say the word and boom, I got 100 airplanes up in the air, and that's really not at all how they worked,
no.
Particularly in World War II. I mean, this is a weapon system that was very slow to react. It took, you know, 40 to 45 minutes to get the planes up on the flight deck, get their engines warmed up, get them, you know, armed in some cases, and get them off the end of the deck. So once Nagumo starts giving those orders, you know, earlier in the morning that he's going to go back out and attack the island of Midway, that sort of sets in motion this sort of chain reaction series of events where he's now wrong-footed for the remainder of the battle, and he never really recovers.
One of the other, you know, kind of the famous, I guess, not exactly correct understandings of the battle is the sacrifice of Torpedo Bomber Squadron 8, VT-8 of the USS Hornet.
Yep.
And famously, all 15 of the airplanes, which was the Douglas TBD Devastator Torpedo Bomber, which probably was pretty devastating in 1936, but by 1942
yeah.
It wasn't particularly devastating at all.
Semi-obsolete.
Flew against the Japanese. All were shot down. Not a single fish reached its target.
Yep.
Only one guy, Ensign George Gay, survived. His rear seat man was killed. But in your book, you go into a fair amount of detail as to why that particular attack really did not have the effect that so many people think it did, and that effect in the minds of many is that it would have brought the Japanese combat air patrol down to sea level, and just
right.
at that moment, I think you had bombing 6, bombing 8, and scouting 8 overhead coming down on the Akagi, the Kaga, and the Soryu. Did
well,
I get those
see, the thing is that
right,
that doesn't happen, and that's the issue.
Okay.
So yeah, the common mythos has always been that the sacrifice of those planes, first VT-8, which came in at about 0917 and attacked and was destroyed by about 0935, And then immediately afterwards, at 0940, their sister squadron, VT-6 from the Enterprise, also attacks and is similarly chewed to pieces. It's not utterly annihilated, but, you know, loses many of its aircraft to no good effect. The American dive bombers don't roll in, understand, until about 10:20. And the bottom line is that a Zero can climb from sea level to 15,000 feet in about 5 minutes flat. So if VT-8 has been, you know, completely shot down and destroyed for, you know, 45 minutes or what have you, 50 minutes before the American dive bombers roll in, and VT-6 similarly has done its thing and has been driven off by about 10 o'clock, which is 20 minutes before the dive bomber attack, it doesn't take too much in the way of mathematics to figure out that those two squadrons didn't make much of a contribution in terms of the altitude of the Japanese cap. And we all understand why we come up with mythos of this nature, because none of us wants to look somebody in the eye and say, you know, your son or your husband died to no effect. I mean, these were American war heroes. They attacked gallantly. They deserved better than they got in terms of combat results. And so, of course, we look for meaning in their sacrifice, and this is the narrative that came out of that. Unfortunately, you know, as I say, that's not the correct interpretation. In my opinion, those two squadrons made a very important contribution to the battle. It's just not the one that we've commonly been led to believe. What those two squadrons did in football parlance is they took 40 minutes off the clock. They kept Nagumo off balance. They prevented Nagumo from putting his reserve strike force planes up on his flight deck. And 40 minutes, you know, coincidentally, is about the exact amount of time that Nagumo would have needed to get those planes up on the flight deck, warmed up, and get them off in the air. And I'm convinced that had not those two squadrons attacked when they did, as ineffective as they were, you know, Nagumo would have launched four squadrons of attack planes to go after our carriers, and that would have been a really, really bad thing. So those two squadrons did make a very important contribution to the battle. It's just not the one that we have been led to believe over the last, you know, 50 years in the history books.
Well, certainly you can't spot airplanes for takeoff if you are constantly making very serious weaving hard turns from port to starboard at 28 or 32 knots or whatever.
Yep.
So, you know, now there's also the famous radio call of "Come on down, Jim," which was never heard by the fighter escort that was supposed to watch out for those guys.
Right. Well, and you know, the tragic part there. So the backstory for our listeners is that when VT-8 went into its attack, there was a group of fighters from another American carrier that were in the neighborhood, and, you know, Waldron, who's the commander of VT-8, you know, yells for help, "Come on down, Jim, I need fighter support," and they don't hear him. Well, you know, I guess the only thing I can say there, horrible as it is to say, is welcome to 1942. You know,
right.
Communications failures were endemic to carrier battles at this time in the war. I mean, you know, it just happened all the time, and this was certainly not the only case. You know, scouting reports got muffed or garbled. I mean, this is a problem all through the beginning phases of the war.
One might also suppose, perhaps parenthetically, that even if the American torpedoes had found their target, the chances are they would not have exploded, because we were having very serious problems with torpedoes at that point, weren't we?
Yeah, although that's a little more ambiguous, because our air-dropped torpedoes were better in terms of operational reliability than certainly our submarine torpedoes were, which were horrible. Sort of the unsung story in terms of our torpedo performance really is our destroyer torpedoes, which were just as awful as our submarine torpedoes, and yet that was never really a scandal during the war. And yet if you look at some of the subsequent surface fights in places like the Solomon Islands, I was just talking with this the other Richard Frank, who wrote a, you know, the book on Guadalcanal, and as far as we can tell, there was never a documented hit by any American destroyer during the 6 months of naval combat during that campaign. I mean, they were just terrible. So,
wow.
Yeah, really, really bad. That, you know, that's sort of what makes 1942 so fascinating, is that there are just all sorts of teething problems that the Americans are going through at this point. You know, we're late to the game. Trying to gear up, trying to get material into the field, and frankly, trying to learn our craft, trying to figure out how do we fight. And, you know, as with any human venture, when you're in the midst of a learning curve, it can be kind of painful.
You mentioned quite a few things in the book. You know, I absolutely love it. I am just a – my dad was a Marine combat pilot in World War II.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, his squadron was VMF 111, and he flew the F-4U Corsair, which, as you know, was an absolute monster.
Fabulous.
And
yeah,
and I, you know, I love that airplane. I've got 6,500 hours as a pilot myself, but I've never flown a Corsair. I've only stood on the wing of one in person, but you know, you mentioned in your book that for every car in Japan in 1940, there were 60 in the United States. And you then extrapolate that America was so much more mechanically inclined and Americans were so much more familiar with internal combustion engines and all the other things that go with them. When the Akagi was blown to bits, and your discussion and description of what it must have been like on the hangar deck.
Absolutely harrowing. Yeah. My God.
Well, your chances of survival were virtually zero. I mean, one of the reasons behind that is that the Japanese hangar decks were not ventilated to the outside the way American carriers were. And beyond that, when the Japanese got that message earlier that morning that there's need for a second attack, they struck their airplanes, took them down to the hangar deck. They began changing from armor-piercing projectiles to ground bombs. Then they got the message from the late scout plane that, hey, they're American carriers. And then they had to do it all over again because Nagumo and Yamamoto wanted to get... So they had rolled bombs, taken them off the airplanes, torpedoes, and instead of moving them into the magazines and removing the fuses and putting them on safe and all that stuff, they didn't have time. They rolled them over to one side. And, I mean, just as that was happening, here comes Dick Best. And, you know, this guy... A Lieutenant Commander Richard H. Best, U.S. Navy, a name like that. There's all kinds of things. And not only was it the Kaga or the Akagi that most people, I think, including yourself, feel that Lieutenant Commander Best's bomb was the one that did the job?
I'm absolutely convinced that it was Best that hit Akagi. I mean, if you look at the pattern, Best had his dive on Kaga spoiled. There was a snafu going on there, and the other squadron was diving his target, and he pulled out at the last minute, managed to pull two of his wingmen out as well, and saw that Akagi was going to get off scot free here. No one was attacking her, and he then hustled over and did it himself. So he's got three planes, and he's coming down on this carrier, and they come down not according to the book. They come down in a rough V formation, and if you look at the forensics on where the bombs landed around Akagi, there's these two paint scraper near misses that come down on her port side, and then one bomb in the middle, which comes down right on the middle of her flight deck. So it's pretty clear that, it's the middle bomb. It's got to be the middle plane. That's Dick Best, and, he's the guy that nailed her. And then he goes out in the afternoon and hits the Hiryu as well. Along with, I should mention too, there's another guy, a pilot off of Off of, oh my goodness. Oh yeah, off of Enterprise, excuse me. Yeah, Dusty Cleese.
Off the Enterprise. Okay.
Yeah, right, who hits Kaga in the morning and then hits Hiryu in the afternoon. So there were two different pilots that hit two carriers that day, and Dusty Cleese is still alive. So,
what was it, he or was it Fieberling that hit them both?
No, it was, as I say,
it was Dusty. Okay.
Yeah. Dusty, okay. Dusty and Richard Best. Unfortunately, Best passed away a few years ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was a fabulous pilot and a good guy from all I understand. I almost met him. Unfortunately, he had a medical emergency when he was coming out to do a filming of a program that I was on, and we didn't end up actually meeting him, but he told a friend of a friend once when he was being interviewed, he's like, yeah, I was the best damn dive bomber pilot in the U.S. Navy, and you really can't argue with it because,
no,
you know, the guy hit
no.
two carriers in a day. That's pretty good shooting. So.
Someone had written an article, I think, in Reader's Digest in 1944, maybe 1946, and I think it was Lieutenant Dickinson, and the name of the article was "The Target Was Utterly Satisfying." And
interesting. I don't know that I've read that one, but yeah, go ahead.
I think I read it at some point in 1971 or something.
Okay.
And when you were four or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. What's the trouble with you kids today? However, he talked about being in his Douglas SBD Dauntless, going into his dive, and right through his aiming scope that he had, which had a ball bank race in the bottom of it, so
right.
the pilot could keep the airplane completely coordinated on the way down.
Yeah.
He rolled out onto the rising sun, which I think is called the Hinumaru or something.
That's right. Yeah, the Japanese painted a big red rising sun right on the middle of their flight decks forward. So,
come on,
yeah,
man.
Beautiful aiming point. Thank you, gentlemen. Yeah, exactly.
What on earth is with those guys? You know,
well,
the
deal was, I mean, there's a reason for that. The reason they put them on was there had actually been some cases of mistaken identification during the Battle of Coral Sea. And as a result of that, the Japanese were determined to make sure that their carriers were identifiable. And so they actually painted those rising sun emblems on the flight decks between the battles. There was a switchover right around that time.
How thoughtful of them.
You yeah,
know, what are the
yeah.
other factors? Another factor that I guess I first read about in Walter Lord, and I think Gordon Prang touched on it as well, is that when the American airplanes, I think we had sent guys out for a second attack. Anyway, the Japanese that were able to get off the Hiryu came looking for our carriers. And the first one that they ran into was the Yorktown.
Yes.
And the Yorktown knew they were coming. And what the engineers on the Yorktown did is they pressurized the aviation fuel spaces and lines with carbon dioxide.
That's right.
Which had the effect
and this
of
is
making
really,
it almost impossible to blow up and fire.
Exactly. And so here's an example, I would say, of what you're seeing is a learning curve in this war. This whole business of draining the fuel lines and putting in CO2, that was a very recent innovation, and it too had occurred just between the time of Coral Sea and Midway, which was only, you know, a bare month. What had happened on Yorktown was her fuel officer, a gentleman by the name of, are you ready for this, Oscar Meyer, had seen what had happened to Yorktown when she was caught with her fuel system engaged, and you know what happened was that she was, you know, immolated. And as he was thinking about this and trying to figure out ways to prevent his own carrier from being exposed similarly, he came up with the idea of, hey, you know, what if we drained the fuel lines and pumped them full of CO2? And he presented this notion he was a relatively junior officer, you know, but he presented this notion, I believe, to Yorktown's damage control officer, and this guy was like, sure, let's try it. So what you're seeing going on in the U.S. Navy then by this time is there's this sort of frantic adaptation happening as again, we're trying to get to grips with this war. How do we beat these guys? How, you know, what do we do to win this war and play the game better than the Japanese? And so you see a lot of innovation on the American side. You see very little of it on the Japanese side. And I think it's pretty clear by this time in the war that, you know, the Americans are starting to win the learning gap, if you will. You know, there's a learning war, I guess you could say. And we are innovating and adapting more quickly to combat conditions than the Japanese are.
The Japanese had a very, very rigid, very controlled, hidebound sort of culture.
Yep.
That had tremendous respect for authority.
Yep.
Would not question authority. And we, you know, Americans, we've always been a little bit suspicious of authority, and we've
yep.
never really been short on coming up with new ideas.
Right.
And that's not a good combination. You also, you go into some detail in Shattered Sword, The Untold Story of the Battle of Midway, about the design of the bridge on the Japanese carriers and how it did not give the commanders the physical space that was necessary under their cultural way of doing things to really be able to reflect and talk and discuss.
Yep.
And, you know, I mean, it's just unbelievable. You know, my dad...
Well, some of that... No, you're absolutely right. The larger point is valid, that the command and control facilities on board Japanese carriers were pretty primitive. Part of what's going on there, though, is you have to understand, again, in the 1930s, these were brand-new weapon systems. No one really knew how to design a carrier. No one knew what
right.
it was supposed to do. And
yeah.
so, you know, as a result, the Japanese put... very, very small bridges on board all of their ships, and the hope being that that would reduce wind turbulence and things like that, which is a bummer. You know, if you're a pilot trying to land a plane on that kind of a flight deck, you would prefer to have as little turbulence on that flight deck as possible. The downside, of course, is that, well, you've got a small island. That doesn't allow you very much in the way of, you know, a flag bridge or, you know, any of that stuff. If you look at American carriers of the same time period, they had much larger islands, and to the point that there were even two separate bridges, one, you know, where the actual ship conning was happening and the other being reserved for the admiral if there was an admiral aboard. And that gave the command staff, the admiral staff, the ability to, you know, go behind closed doors and argue things out if need be without having to do it in front of, you know, the rest of the ship's crew. Didn't have that luxury on the carrier Akagi. I mean, her bridge is a trapezoid that's roughly 11 feet on a side. You've got, you know, a dozen guys packed into this thing. It's a fishbowl. So... you know, yeah, the command facilities were kind of miserable. You can kind of see where they were coming from, though, in that, again, these were relatively new weapon systems and very much untried, and people really didn't know what you needed to have on a carrier in order to make it smoothly functioning.
And the Akagi, I think it's the Akagi, the only carrier in naval history to have its island or bridge on the left side.
Actually,
of the Hiryu
does
deck,
too.
Right?
Yeah,
oh,
here
okay,
you also. Yeah,
you.
But yeah, they were very, very rare cats. Let's put it that way.
And at that point, at least going into World War II, the Japanese Navy was considered to be the most technologically advanced naval force in the world.
I think we would say that in retrospect. I don't think that. That the Americans had that same view of the Japanese carrier force at the outset. It really took Pearl Harbor to make the Americans wake up to the fact that, yeah, this is a first-class opponent. And actually, you know, the big innovation that the Japanese put forward at the beginning of the war, the thing that really set them apart, and the thing that made Pearl Harbor possible, was the fact that the Japanese had made the conceptual leap towards stopping using their carriers in onesie-twosies and actually putting together in a cohesive striking force. The thing that makes Pearl Harbor so astonishing is not that they raided Pearl Harbor. People have been talking, you know, that there was a possibility of a raid against Pearl Harbor for years. But it had always been anticipated that, you know, that would be like maybe one carrier would come over and, you know, strafe some stuff. Nobody on our side of the pond had put together the notion that, wait a minute, what if they bring six carriers with 350 airplanes? And when they put those airplanes together in strike packages off the flight deck, they're not going to be in carrier-sized packets. They're going to be in multi-carrier-sized packets. So what you see is when they hit Oahu, they're not only hitting the naval anchorage, they are also devoting enough air power to shut down all of the air bases on the island and annihilate the ground-based aircraft there, and they're doing it all simultaneously. That is a quantum leap in terms of firepower, and it's a quantum leap in terms of the strategic results that the Japanese could create on the battlefield. That was a trump card that they had that nobody else had at the beginning of the war. And that's really one of the things that makes the loss at Midway so devastating to them, is that they have this trump card at the beginning of the war, and then they throw it away unnecessarily. And now with, you know, the carrier construction programs that are underway on our side of the pond, which the Japanese have no ability to forestall. I mean, you know, they can't do anything about what our shipyards are doing. You know, we're just going to crush them under production. That is
for
not
a variety of reasons.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and we're not going to see those snazzy new Essex-class carriers. Those aren't going to start showing up really until the middle of 1943. But, man, you know, starting middle of 43 and from there on out, you know, we're putting a new carrier in the water every other month and, you know, throwing in 124 Jeep carriers and blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, we just destroy them in terms of shipbuilding. So throwing away that trump card in June of 1942, they're never going to be able to get it back. That is an enormous strategic accomplishment on our part.
The Japanese made an unbelievable number of errors, and they certainly had some bad luck. We, on the other hand, somehow we were just able to do almost everything right under the circumstances. We
yep.
had a lot of good luck on our side. Everything
yep.
from, you know, Operation K, which was the famously the French frigate Shoals, very, very small outcropping of rock, where the Japanese had planned to land float planes, which were going to be refueled by submarines. They were going to put up a submarine cordon ostensibly to take out the American fleet when it sailed out of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And when the Japanese showed up there, there was an American PBY that was at anchor, so they figured, all right, well, we're not going to do anything. They never heard from Operation K, so I guess he figured, hey, no news is good news.
Yep.
It's unbelievable. My dad at one point, and this is, you know, this, I look back now and I think to myself, all right, my dad was 22 when mm-hmm. he had this experience. His squadron and four other squadrons of Corsairs, Marine Corsairs, were going to bomb either Kwajalein or Eniwetok or Macon or one of those islands.
One of those,
there.
Yeah.
My dad was in the middle section of his squadron. His squadron was in the middle of the other three or four or five squadrons surrounding him.
Right.
And my dad is 22, and he is surrounded by American military combat airplanes with a 1,000-pound bomb under each one. And my dad said to me, at that point, I thought to myself, what are these Japs out of their minds? What
yeah.
on earth did they think they were against the power, the industrial might of the... I mean, in 1944, 50% of all industrial output in the world came from
the United States. Yep.
Unbelievable.
Yep. Well, you know, of course, the Japanese were fighting an intentionally short-sighted war. The game plan always was that they were going to beat us in 6 months to a year. And the more rational amongst their high command understood that in a protracted war, they really didn't stand much of a chance. The problem is, and I find this really ironic, they had this doctrine, their whole naval doctrine was built around the concept of fighting decisive naval battles, with the notion being that if you win a decisive naval battle, that is going to force the other guy to come to the bargaining table and, you know, negotiate peace terms. This is exactly what had worked for them during the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-05. They win the Battle of Tsushima, and sure enough, the Russians have got to come to the table. So here they go off to Midway, and they fight a decisive naval battle, and they are decisively beaten, and yet you don't see them cozying up to the negotiating table. And in fact, if you look throughout the remainder of the war, they fought a number of other decisive, what they would term decisive naval engagements. They lost every single one of them, and yet, you know, apparently decisive naval victories or decisive naval defeats are really only for the other guy. We're not affected by that stuff. So, yeah, that's really why, for me, frankly, the end of the war is not all that interesting, because it does sort of turn into a walkover. The disparity of forces is just so outsized. You know, the Japanese are so outclassed, not only in terms of numbers, but also in terms of quality and pilot quality and any other indice that you'd care to name, that, yeah, you kind of have to wonder why it is that they were continuing to fight. But, you know, that's the nature of their culture, and that's, you know, you certainly can't compel them to surrender if they don't want to. So, yeah.
No, I've heard so many historians and military history analysts and people like that have said, you know, the Japanese were beaten by the summer of 1945, but they didn't know that they were beaten. And
yep.
we had to put that exclamation mark coming out of the Enola Gay in order to make sure that they got the message.
Right.
But now, when did the book came out in 2005.
I think
I probably got it last year or the year before. I've read quite a few of the Midway books, including Fuchida's book called Midway, The
sure.
Battle That Doomed Japan, and a great one that's called A Dawn Like Thunder, about the whole history of Torpedo 8.
Yep.
By Bob
Mrazek.
Congressman.
Yeah,
yep. But when did you and Anthony Tully begin writing this book?
It actually started off as a result of an undersea expedition that we were part of. There was a company called Nauticos that went out in 1999 and was looking for the Japanese carriers. It's an undersea exploration company. They found a big chunk of junk down on the bottom, and down at about 17,000 feet, and they didn't know which carrier it came off of. I had, and still have, a website devoted to the Imperial Navy, and they found us on the Internet, and, you know, it took a couple of months to get all the legal paperwork in place, non-disclosures and all that happy stuff, but it eventually Tony and I were able to, you know, get a look at the photographs, and within a matter of a few hours we were able to tell them, yeah, you found a chunk off of the Kaga, big chunk of wreckage about as big as a house, that must have gotten blown off during the time that she was burning after she had been, you know, dive bombed. She's crawling away to the northwest and spitting chunks of herself off as she's, you know, suffering detonations in her hangar decks and so forth. So anyway, as a result of doing the work to identify that wreckage, Tony and I, who both had a very long interest in the Imperial Navy, just kind of looked at each other and like, you know, the Japanese side of this story has never really been told all that well. Maybe there's a book here. And lo and behold, you know, 6 years later, there was a book. So, yeah, it took a long time to write. But, It was a really fun project. Tony's a great guy to work with, very, very good with the Japanese sources. And, you know, sort of serendipitously, this project kind of fell in our laps. And I understand how incredibly fortunate I am. I mean, Midway is one of the, you know, probably the four or five most important naval battles or any sort of a battle in American military history.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
You think of the biggies, you know, the biggies are Gettysburg, Pearl Harbor, Midway, D-Day, and Battle of the Bulge. Those are the books that any historian, you know, would give their eye teeth to be able to write something new and original and interesting about. And, you know, here are these two guys. Yeah, I've got the skill set, and I have the interest in the Japanese side of things, but this thing just kind of falls in our lap, and the book has done very, very well. So am I lucky? Yeah, I'm a really lucky guy.
Yeah, now you, I mean, I'm sure many people listening have seen that movie with Henry Fonda and Charlton,
sure.
And you know, I got to be honest with you, I thought it was like a really, really weak movie.
I have not seen that movie since it first came out, and
you're lucky.
I had the same reaction to it that you did. My problem with it was, even as a, I don't know, I was like 12 or something like that, you know, obviously they didn't have the computer graphics that we have now, but I just remember there was this one shot where they cut away to a shot of an American, you know, Sumner-class destroyer or something like that, a Forrest Sherman, and, you know, this is a 5,000-ton ship, and the caption reads, you know, Imperial Battleship Yamato, which was this 72,000-ton behemoth.
Right.
And,
with
18-inch
guns.
Yeah, exactly. And right there, you know, my disbelief, even as a 12-year-old, was suspended.
You bet.
That was the end of that movie for me. But
there was another sequence in which they were, I think they were doing a torpedo eights last moments.
Right.
And I think at one point they tried to use the TBF as the airplane of Torpedo 8. There was a detached Torpedo 8 that operated out of Midway, and that was the first time that the Grumman TBF Avenger, which
That's
is the
right.
airplane that President George H.W. Bush flew later in the war, was
Correct.
Ever used in combat.
Yeah, and it was a pretty harrowing introduction to combat.
Yeah, absolutely. But they see a TBF, and then you see an F-4F in the water, and then they cut to Charlton Heston with a look of tremendous concern on his face or something.
Right.
And then you see an F-6F in the water. Oh, please, you've got to be kidding.
Yeah, there were some problems with the archival footage there, I think it's safe to say.
Yes, absolutely. Now, you mentioned when we spoke on the phone a while ago, that the same people that did Band of Brothers and The Pacific on HBO are now looking at doing one about Midway?
I've heard that, yes. But I was actually just yakking with Rich Frank about this again just like last night, and he was saying that last he heard that project is on hold, which is too bad because, you know, obviously now with the things we can do with computer graphics, I think that we could actually fairly accurately portray that battle and what happened on Flight Deck. So that, you know, I think it'd be really cool to see that, frankly, and it would make a really good movie, just as long as, you know, we can cut the love story to an absolute minimum, not to name names of previous movie attempts, but I think we all know what I'm talking about. So.
Yeah, you know, that film that came out in 2000 called Pearl Harbor.
I'm not going there. I'm not going to badmouth anybody.
Well, I'm not going to badmouth anybody, but, well, okay, I'm going to badmouth some people. I've got to be honest with you. I don't understand. Listen, James Cameron is a brilliant filmmaker. His movie Titanic.
Yep.
It was a fabulous film. But I've always thought, you know, the sinking of the Titanic, there is enough human drama in that event why would you have to dress it up with this story of these star-crossed lovers in the Edwardian era? I don't get that. And likewise, Pearl Harbor.
Right.
You know, there was enough human drama there. You just did not need to embellish it at all.
Right.
But now, I want to make sure everybody knows about three of your websites. One of them is CombinedFleet.com. Tell us a little bit about that one.
CombinedFleet.com is actually one of the oldest internet websites around. I put it up in 1995 when I was hideously bored, had just gotten a job as a consultant and for Deloitte & Touche, and was having a little too much to do with business kind of reading and wanted to get back to the Imperial Navy. But, you know, back in the day, of course, 95, I mean, a lot of websites back then, of course, were, you know, 2 pages worth of somebody rambling and maybe a picture of their dog. And, you know, here I came out with this thing that had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages of content on it, and that was sort of unusual. I'm embarrassed to admit that it still looks like a 1995 vintage website, but it still gets 100,000 visitors a month, and it's sort of become the repository for TROMs, which are track records of movement. So if you want to know, you know, what a given Japanese destroyer, you know, pick your favorite destroyer, you can go out to my website, and through the efforts of my core of volunteers that have been laboring on this thing for years, you know, you can track a lot of these ships practically day by day, where they were, what they were doing, yada, 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 hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. So it's it is still, even now, you know, 20 years almost past the time when it was put up. You know, there are still a lot of people that use it for research purposes because it's sort of a good repository for those sorts of movement records.
I don't know how anybody could ever come up with any more thorough documented dissection and description of the Battle of Midway than you and Anthony Tully did in Shattered Sword. Now, another website is shatteredswordbook.com.
Right, which is just the promotional website for the book itself. I put that up when you know, we were getting close to actually launching the thing, and we had no idea if anybody was, you know, ever going to hear about it or know about it. The book is very easy to obtain now. You know, you can go out to Barnes & Noble or Amazon. You can get it anywhere. And it's still on, you know, Barnes & Noble shelves on a relatively frequent basis. So, yeah, it's, as I say, it's done pretty well.
You have also made it. Now, I guess I mentioned 3 websites. Do you have a third one?
Not at this point.
That?
No, just those two. I will be putting up a website when my next book project gets a little further along. I'm writing a new history of the year 1942, which, as you probably gathered, is my special pride and joy, I guess, in terms of research, or really of interest. That is the year I think is, you know, kind of the linchpin of the whole war, really. That's when the Allies have got to prove that they can turn this train wreck around and actually, you know, go to toe-to-toe with the Axis and beat them. So, a crucial year.
When do you expect that book to be out?
I'm thinking it's probably going to be another 3 or 4 years, to be honest with you. I mean, this is not my day job. I am I'm the COO of a little software company in St. Paul, Minnesota. That's how I pay my bills. So I write history for fun, and I work on it every night. I can tell you that my agent, Jim Hornfisher, who is another very good naval historian, is definitely breathing down my neck and would like it out there as quickly as possible. But I do these things to educate me rather than necessarily to make money. And so, you know, the book will be done when the book is done. That's kind of what it comes down to.
Well, I was going to ask if you would mind remaining on hold with me, you know, until the book is published so that you can be the first, you know, this will be the first interview when John's new book comes out. I can't wait for the new book to come out. I am glad The Shattered Sword is still in the bookstores, and it should be. And, John, you know, I've got to be honest with you. I've kind of been in something like I am not worthy mode all night just to be able to talk to you because fascinated me.
Well,
thank you. 67, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, and it is a fascinating battle. I mean, it's a very complex, interesting, deep battle that requires a lot of examination and interpretation. So I'm glad you had a good time. I'm delighted
Thank
I
you.
Could be here. And I'll look forward to hopefully coming back again sometime.
I hope to get you back very, very soon. My friend, thanks so much for spending so much time with me. I'd be happy to engage you on this for another 2 or 3 hours. I just cannot learn enough about this, but that's not practical. Thank you so much, John.
You too. Thank you, Duke. Have
Thank
a great
you, my
night.
My friend. Have a great night, sir. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
That was John Parshall. And seriously, I I've got to be honest with you, I really just during that discussion, I didn't do the things I was supposed to do. I know our general manager is in the chat room and she was sending me signals that, it's time to take a break. It's time to put out the phone number. She's absolutely right about those things. But I completely lost it. And all I wanted to do was talk to John Parshall about the Battle of Midway and his absolutely stunning book, Shattered Sword, The Untold Story of the Battle of Midway. If you are even remotely interested in the Battle of Midway, if you are interested at all in World War II, and you want something like an introduction to the two key battles in the first 6 months of the war, which obviously were Pearl Harbor and Midway, I would recommend without reservation or hesitation, if you want to study Pearl Harbor, the key books to read are Day of Infamy by Walter Lord, and chapter 3 of that book, which is called I Can't Keep Throwing Things at Them, it's a quote. This, I think, is the most exciting chapter of combat narrative that's ever been written. Reading it, my heart was pounding. I reread it every once in a while. It's almost the same as having a workout, I guess. I don't know. The definitive, I suppose, academic study of Pearl Harbor is called At Dawn We Slept by Gordon Prang, the late professor of history at the University of Maryland, Don Goldstein, and Catherine Dillon. Now, flash forward 6 months later to Midway, and to get a front row seat at the battle, don't watch that stupid movie Midway. God, it was a bad movie. It was terrible. Don't watch that. Rather get Walter Lord's book, Incredible Victory. It is just, it's one of the books you can't put it down. It is just amazing. You can't put it down. And Jonathan Parshall and Tony Tully's book, Shattered Sword. There are other books about Midway. There are great ones. Prang, Goldstein, and Dillon wrote Miracle at Midway, and I think that was an apt title. Midway was John obviously knows more about it than anyone does. There are a couple of people alive that were still there. I saw a great ceremony on the Pentagon Channel the other day that came from the U.S. Navy Memorial at World in Washington, D.C., and it looked to me like there were maybe a dozen, perhaps 18 actual veterans of the Battle of Midway who were still alive, and they were receiving commendations from the U.S. Navy, which they should. But it is just a fascinating thing. And yeah, I'm sorry I didn't get to the Civil War tonight, and I didn't get to Common Sense with Kevin Wade, and there's a bunch of commercials that I didn't make it to, and I'm very, very sorry, and I hope that our general manager does not fire me for that. Anyway, we have about a minute to go. Thanks so much for being along this evening. Don't forget tomorrow night. is The Sound of Freedom with Hig and Resch at 7 p.m. Eastern. On Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern, The Christopher Manti Show. Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock Eastern, The New Wise Conservatism Show. And Sunday at 4 o'clock Eastern is Soldiers of Patriotism. Duke Brooks here. Thanks for being along, and I'll speak with you next week. Have a wonderful week.